From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this week's podcast, trying to evaluate how trustworthy Bashar al-Assad is when it comes to giving up Syria's chemical weapons.
This is a man who has gassed civilians and killed over 100,000 people. I don't put anything beyond what he might do.
And Eric Andre, host of the weirdest show on TV, gets a taste of NPR. And he wants more.
Do you have Terry Gross's cell phone number?
Terry Gross, holler at me.
Also, Christmas music from an unexpected source, the king of ironic songwriters, Nick Lowe.
I was born in Bethlehem.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. But first, to an esteemed writer that you've likely never heard of. Goli Taraghi writes about life in Iran, about love and loss, alienation and exile. Her own exile began in 1980. She was a professor living in Tehran with two young children.
I must confess that I really believed first in this revolution.
But it quickly became clear that freedom and democracy were not a part of the revolution.
Of course, the turmoil started and then the executions and the university was closed. So I thought that the best thing is for the time being to go abroad and stay only 1 year. But little I knew that I will end up 34 years living in Paris.
During those years, Goli Taraghi returned to Iran many times. Her work made her one of Iran's most successful and celebrated authors. Her latest collection of short stories is called The Pomegranate Lady and Her Sons.
Usually I go to Iran to find a story to write about because Iran is so absurd, so contradictory. So whenever I go, I find something to write about, and I have a character, you know, that sits in the waiting room of my head to enter into a new story. And Pomegranate Lady is one of them that I met her at the airport, and she was asking everybody, where is Sweden? Where is Sweden? Because she said, my son sent me a ticket and said that, Nanny, come, come. So I'm here with the ticket, but I don't know how to go.
One thing about her, though, is that, she could be a very sad character, but she's, even though she doesn't speak the language and is completely in an alien world, she's undaunted.
Yes, it's true. Most of the characters, you know, are tragic and comic. For example, in the story, The Gentleman Thief, that story is true, because after the revolution, a new category of thieves appeared. They used to be, for example, an employee of a bank or in a ministry of justice or something, but they're out of job and they have no money. So they absolutely need some money. And they very, very, you know, apologize for taking something from your house and they promise that they will bring it back. So the whole thing, you know, goes on an absurd way.
You know, I read most of this book on an airplane.
Yes.
And it turned out that was the perfect setting for this, because so much of this, these characters, it's about their movement, their exile, and their dislocation.
Yes, right. I have one story which is not included in this collection, but I hope one day also will be included. It's called The Flying Mothers. A lot of Iranian mothers are the real victim of this revolution, because children, they had to leave and they couldn't take the grandmothers or mothers with them. This woman in this story, she has sold her house and given the money to her children, so she has no house of her own. And when she comes to Paris to see her son, it's difficult for the son because the apartment is small and he's married and has two children. So he sends her after a while to her daughter in London. The daughter is married to an Englishman, so they cannot keep her long enough. They send her to Canada. And the only house or home, real, that belongs to her is her seat in the airplane. Nobody can take it away from her.
I don't think of these stories as political stories per se, but at the same time, politics intrudes roughly on all the lives of these characters. What kind of situation have you faced with censorship of your work in Iran?
In Iran, it's a very strange game of a cat and a mouse. And the problem is that when I want to submit a book, I automatically do the auto-censoring, you know. Sex is impossible, religion is impossible, politics is impossible. Second censorship is by the publisher, that he takes this sentence, finally it goes to the Ministry of Irshad. And the man, stupid man sitting there, you know, he cuts a paragraph, he cuts a sentence, he cuts a page. Mutilated story finally is published and I'm happy. But it often happens that the book sells well. People, you know, are excited about it and they say, what is in it? Maybe we didn't see. And then they confiscate a book from the bookshops. In Persian, everything is mingled with poetry. We have a poem which says that if God by his wisdom closes a door, with his grace he opens another door. Iranians are always waiting for this another door, you know. No door is definitely closed.
That's Goli Taraghi. Her collection of short stories, The Pomegranate Lady and Her Sons, has just been published in English. This week, the world mourned the death of Nelson Mandela. And in South Africa, they'll be mourning and celebrating the great man for another week. Last Saturday, NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arkton joined those singing, dancing, and marking the life of the man they call the father of the nation.
This is Houghton, where Nelson Mandela lived and where he died on Thursday. Outside his house, there are literally dozens, hundreds of South Africans who have come to pay tribute, lay flowers, and messages of love, support, and appreciation. Now, with me, three generations of one family. Ma'am, your name, please.
My name is Rukaya Ishak. I'm from Lanesia, Johannesburg. It's a very special moment for us. He has brought freedom to us, and it's a day of celebration. A day of mourning, but a day of celebration for the history of South Africa. Freedom, justice, dignity. We will try and live by what he has taught us. He has left us behind with a lot of inspiration. Most of all, our freedom and our dignity in South Africa to our children. And I'm here today for them to know what Nelson Mandela was all about. I'm here to celebrate that.
Sure, my name is Ridwan Eshak. I'm also from Lanesia in Johannesburg. I'm 30 years old. This for me is part of closure. It's about the closure of what the legacy of apartheid has led us to. The indignities that we suffered as non-whites. The simply being treated as a third-class human. With the passing of Mandela, that has now closed. And we're now experiencing a brand new freedom, brand new democracy. Although we've lost a grandfather, we've got generations ahead of us. But I'm hugely optimistic about the country, and let's see where it goes.
My name is Godsat Eshak. I came to mourn the death of Nelson Mandela, not celebrate. My heart is very sore. He was a very good man. Oh, he was a very good man. This man will go straight.
And you're pointing upwards to heaven.
Heaven.
So what is his legacy for older South Africans like you, ma'am?
To think what they did to him, and he still forgave
his enemy.
His enemy.
He forgave his enemies.
He was a very great man. To forgive is not easy.
We were praising Madiba. Everything he did for us. My name is Cynthia Novatin. I was singing Madiba Wahalele like we were praising him. Like he is a shining star for us.
This is remarkable. It really is the rainbow nation that Nelson Mandela spoke about, that Nelson Mandela wanted his South Africa to be. There are black South Africans, white South Africans, Asian South Africans, Muslim South Africans, people of all races, colors, and creeds have gathered here outside the home in Houghton where Nelson Mandela died. Excuse me, ma'am. Do you feel able to talk now? I saw you being a bit tearful. First of all, I'm going to ask you your name, please.
Oh, I'm Adele Stein.
And I saw you weeping, ma'am.
It's the first time in my life that I'm really proud, so proud to be South African. So not anymore ashamed of what we've done, but proud. Just to be part of everyone here, and there's no more barriers, I'm proud of that. I was ashamed for so many years for what happened, but I'm not anymore. I feel part of everyone here. I don't think I need to have a burden anymore.
And is that because of Nelson Mandela?
I think so, yes. Because he forgave. That, I think, was all that prevented bloodshed. Yes.
Ofer Biakos-Clarkton, NPR News, at Nelson Mandela's home in Houghton, Johannesburg.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. As of Friday, all of Syria's unfilled chemical munitions had been destroyed. That's according to the Organization for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. For an agreement reached just weeks ago, that may seem fast, but the job has just begun, and the scariest part is still ahead. They may have destroyed the munitions, but not the nasty stuff that goes inside. When it comes to chemical weapons, it's the chemical part that's key. A lot of attention has been paid to the method the U.S. will be using to destroy those chemicals at sea. But according to Amy Smithson, senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, the U.S. knows how to do that. It's what happens before that worries her.
As far as I know, the Syrian government has not declared any filled weapons that contain the blister agent mustard or the nerve agent sarin. Instead, what they've declared is a whole lot of bulk chemicals, and that's what is being packaged to move toward the port of Latakia. Once the materials get on board a ship, the warfare agent will be destroyed in hydrolysis system.
The United States has had a difficult time finding partners in the international community to help with the destruction of these materials. What's behind that?
That's not entirely surprising. Anyone familiar with the history of the U.S. chemical weapons destruction program will know the NIMBY, not in my backyard, attitude that anyone takes when it comes to destruction of chemical weapons. In the U.S. program, high temperature incineration was originally the technology, and there were such public protests about high temperature incineration that they had to come up with new technologies. And that's how we came to develop the neutralization technology.
Amy, I know you're familiar with the issues, complicated issues around verification for this sort of thing. So how confident can we feel that these are all of the chemical weapons from the Assad regime?
I, at present, am not confident that the Assad regime has declared everything. In fact, their declaration largely resembles what has been stated publicly by the U.S. government and other governments about what they think the Syrian government had in its chemical arsenal. This is a man who has gassed civilians and engaged in war over the course of 2 years plus and killed over 100,000 people. I don't put anything beyond what he might do in terms of maybe cheating on this agreement.
Well, what's the nightmare scenario? What could happen to these things, the worst thing that could happen to these materials?
It is unprecedented that materials be destroyed at sea, but really it's much more routine, a standard operational procedure, because these are such proven technologies. The threat in this process is on land in Syria. Syria is overrunning with fighters of all types, Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and they might want to get their hands on these chemicals. So, quite frankly, might the Syrian government decide to dress somebody up as a rebel and go in there and take it back, thereafter being able to use the materials and accuse the rebels, as they have, of using chemical weapons. This is an unprecedented thing for a government that has acquired a weapon of mass destruction to relinquish it in the midst of war. I'm very pleased that the Obama administration stood up to enforce the norm against chemical weapons use and possession. And I'm pleased that the Syrian government appears to be cooperating. I don't trust them, but they appear to be doing many of the right things in this process thus far. But we don't know what we don't know.
Amy Smithson is senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Amy, thank you.
My pleasure.
Turning now to Asia and back to 2007. It was the height of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Neighboring Pakistan was increasingly unstable, but former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto decided to return from exile, vowing to bring democracy with her. Just 2 months later, she was dead, killed by a suicide bomber. The circumstances of her death and who was responsible remain shrouded in mystery. Geraldo Munoz led the UN investigation into her murder. Now he's written a book on that investigation and its findings. He says despite Pakistan's instability, Bhutto was determined to return.
She felt that it was her duty to go back. She had been prime minister twice. Both times she had not been able to complete her period. She had been dismissed by the army, the intelligence services, under accusations of corruption. And this time, we're talking about 2007, the country was undergoing huge instability. The suicide bombings had multiplied in the country, and you had a dictatorship again led by General Musharraf. And the U.S. and the U.K. saw Benazir Bhutto as an answer to the problems. They felt that they needed the legitimacy that Benazir Bhutto could bring to Pakistan, the stability, democracy, rule of law.
On her return, she made a mystery of the fact that she was concerned about her safety. Why?
Well, there were many signals and intelligence information that there would be cells, extremist cells, that would attack her, that would seek to kill her. She also had information that people around Musharraf wanted to kill her. In fact, she sent a letter to Musharraf saying that three individuals, a former head of the ISI, the intelligence service of Pakistan, Hamid Gul, the head of the intelligence bureau, Ishaq Shah, and someone else, a head of the provincial government of Punjab, were plotting against her. So she felt that there was a high risk of going back, but nevertheless she felt that she had no other choice, that this was her destiny.
And there was an attempt on her life almost as soon as she gets there. And then, sure enough, 2 months later, in December of 2007, is when the assassination occurs. She's at a rally. There are gunshots and explosions. There's a lot of confusion. How did she die?
Well, she's in this park in the city of Rawalpindi near Islamabad. And she's quite happy about the results of the rally, and she's going away from this park. And despite the protection that she was to be afforded by the police is nowhere to be found. And there's a huge number of people around her vehicle, and an individual fires and then blows himself up, a suicide bomber, and kills 38 people, including Benazir Bhutto. Many stories around this I began to discover in this investigation, including that there was a backup car that was bulletproof that was nowhere to be found.
A lot of dispute over how Benazir Bhutto actually died. What was it, from a gunshot? Was it from the blast? The government even said it was because she hit her head. Do you have a sense out of your investigation, a sense of clarity about how she actually died?
I think she died out of the blast by hitting her head on the lip of the escape hatch. There was no autopsy done because the police impeded that from being carried out. So we never know exactly the cause of death, but the best we can say is that it was a blast and her hitting her head as a consequence of the blast.
And what about the likely suspects? And there's always discussion of the role of the intelligence services, the ISI, may have played.
Well, I've been thinking hard about that, because our commission did not have the duty to establish responsibilities for the perpetration of the assassination, only to establish the facts and circumstances. But I thought strong about that. In the book, I came out with a sort of metaphor. There's a play in Spain, an old play, 17th century, called Fuente Ovejuna, which is about this ruler of a village who's very much hated by the population. And he's assassinated one day. And a judge comes in from out of town, begins to interrogate every villager. And every villager says, Fuente Ovejuna did it. The village did it. In a sense, I think Fuente Ovejuna did the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. The village did it, because Al-Qaeda was certainly behind it. They gave the order. The Pakistani Taliban executed it. The local police was involved in a cover-up, in my view, because they washed the scene of the crime 1.5 hours immediately, removing a lot of important evidence.
They just hosed it down.
Exactly. And the U.S. and the U.K. promoted the return, but without providing any security. They didn't want to take any responsibility for that. And in the end, most political actors would rather turn the page rather than continue to investigate who did it. So in a sense, she was part of the circumstances of her time, and there were many people that wanted to do her harm.
Geraldo Munoz led the United Nations investigation into the 2007 assassination of Pakistan's former Prime Minister, Benazir Bhutto. His new book is called Getting Away with Murder. Geraldo Munoz, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's time now for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, good to be with you.
Nice to have you back. So we've had some interesting news in the world of sports. That we had the World Cup draw took place yesterday. So we know the teams that are going to be head-to-head next summer. Now, I've been an England fan for a long time, and it feels like England's been cursed for about 50 years in the World Cup. There have been all these frustrating, awful endings, but you were here to tell me that there might be a savior, literally a savior.
Well, you know, no two ways about it. So England loves its soccer. You know, a lot of people say combine Americans' love of the NBA and the NFL, and that would represent English love for soccer. Now, England hasn't won, as you said, in almost 50 years, since 1966. Tons of heartbreak, including in the last World Cup in a match against the U.S. But now here comes a strapping young fella, 6'4", 210-pound goalie named John Ruddy, who was kind of an obscure guy, struggled with his first big league opportunity there, or Premier League as they call it, but has come on recently, joined their national team, and this time around is bucking not only to become the starter on the national team, but perhaps their star. And if that happens, there could be a new name that many Americans and many people around the globe become familiar with, John Ruddy, English soccer star.
Well, in British fashion, I'm going to try not to get my hopes up too high just yet. But there's been a lot of hand-wringing over the last several months about what's happened with the Arab Spring. And you have an activist you feature that she's got an interesting perspective on it.
Maryam Al-Khwaja, who's a 26-year-old activist in Bahrain, calls herself appropriately the accidental activist. While she grew up in a family of activists who've been protesting for more freedom in that oil-rich country of about a million people, the reality is she actually tried to step away from it, but found herself constantly drawn to it. And ultimately, when her father was arrested, sister arrested, brother-in-law arrested, and not only arrested but beaten, she found herself drawn to that work and trying to stimulate a furtherance of the Arab Spring effort there in Bahrain. And she now, by the way, is living in exile in Copenhagen. But one of the interesting things she said, I thought this was very telling and insightful. She said, "I'm not doing this because I'm assured an outcome. I'm doing this because it's right. And whether it takes 20 years, 50 years, or 70 years, I've got to commit myself to it in that way." Not many of us would say that genuinely at any time. Not many of us would say it at age 26, and not many of us probably could say that knowing that their father and their sister are in jail as we speak.
Yeah. Finally this week, of course, the world has been mourning the passing of Nelson Mandela. Ozzy spoke with President Clinton several weeks back. Here's what he had to say about Nelson Mandela.
Mandela really taught me why, in practical terms, hatred was a dead bang loser. We had a talk with that. I said, "Now, I know that you later invited your jailers to your inauguration. You even put the people who put you in prison in your cabinet. But didn't you hate him again?" He said, "Briefly, I did." But he said, "I realized if I hated him when I got outside that gate, I would still be their prisoner."
That's incredibly powerful, and it's a reminder of Mandela and his 95 years, all the many things and the many lessons he taught.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talk about at npr.org/newandnext. Carlos, thank you.
Arun, always good to be with you.
David Letterman takes to the stage with a wave and a smile. Jay Leno comes out and shakes hands with the audience. Eric Andre does this.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Eric Andre Show!
You can kind of get a sense of it without me really describing it. He basically is a maniac, goes into an uncontrollable rage, destroying everything around him as the band plays on. This actually is a comedy program, a different kind of comedy program. It's sort of like Louis Buñuel directing Jackass. The Eric Andre Show lasts just 15 minutes, and it appears in the middle of the night on the Cartoon Network. Still, it's generated a rabid fan base. Host Eric Andre is here with me in the studio. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for not trashing the studio.
No problem.
I don't think it's quite as breakaway, though.
I'd get hurt.
Have you ever hurt yourself doing that?
Yeah, I hurt myself during Vivica Fox interview. I hurt my back really bad.
You go flying through the wall, destroy your desk in multiple ways.
Yeah, I jumped on my desk and landed right on my tuchus during the Vivica Fox interview, and I just like wrenched my back and just sent a shockwave up my spine.
Wow.
Yeah, my back still feels kind of asymmetrical.
You suffer for your art.
Yeah, you know, I'm an idiot.
Well, beyond the insane opening, or I mean, not that the show gets saner as you go along, but could you try to explain the show for people who have not seen it?
It is like a kind of like a mock talk show or an anti-talk show where I just destroy the talk show from the beginning to the end. Deconstructing like the fact that most talk show hosts have to just be like overly polite and pump up the guest and be like, "You're so great, Victoria's Secret model that doesn't know anything. We're best friends." And I just think it's way funnier for a host to just be like completely uninformed and spaced out and apathetic.
I want to give people a sense of the show. Here's maybe a typical celebrity interview, Eric Andre style. This is with Mel B.
Oh, great.
Former Spice Girl. And, it's a pretty typical sort of question.
Do you think Margaret Thatcher had girl power?
Yes, of course.
Do you think she effectively utilized girl power by funneling money to illegal paramilitary death squads in Northern Ireland?
I don't know about that, but help me out. Just stand there. Help me out.
I bet she hasn't been asked that question before.
I think I threw her off a little bit.
Be honest, how much do the celebrity guests that you have on, are they in on the joke? Do they know what they're getting into?
To varying degrees, some people are totally in the dark. Some people don't even know the name of the show or who I am before they do it. Like we had Demi Lovato on the show for the New Year special. And I called her up. I just wanted to like call her up and be like, "Hey, thanks so much for doing the show," before she came on. And she goes, "I just want to let you know I've seen your $1 billion movie 100 times." And I was like, "Oh no, that's Eric Wareheim. That's Tim and Eric, Eric." And then she goes, "Oh." And I was like, "I'm Eric Andre." And she's like, And then I was just like, "See you tomorrow." And so I just kept my fingers crossed that she wouldn't cancel. But, Lou Ferrigno had no idea what was going on. We have this great promo.
Lou Ferrigno got kind of uncomfortable.
He came the closest to walking out of any guest we've ever had. Please welcome the original Hulk, Lou Ferrigno!
Still a big guy.
It's huge. It's a monster. We wrangled him back in, but he was upset. We had this skinny Asian guy. We painted him green, and he came out as the Hulk while I was interviewing Lou Ferrigno. I was like, "Lou, hold on a second. My next guest is the Incredible Hulk." And this little Asian guy came out and sat next to him and just kept hitting on Lou the entire interview.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
Don't get makeup on my arm.
I'm attracted to you.
Don't do it. It'll be a bad.
What I like was that Lou wasn't quite homophobic. It was more of like, "You're not going to get green on me."
Yeah, he was more worried about, he was more concerned with the paint getting on him.
It's tense here, man.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I'm on TV, I'm not joking. Don't get closer to me, okay?
But he looked at me, he's like, "Did you bring me on the show specifically to mock me?" And I was like, "So what have you been up to? I was Celebrity Apprentice."
That's kind of a thing, though. Did you?
No, I mean, I don't think
it's a fine line sometimes.
It's a fine line,
humor,
but
I think
it's a fine line. I think it's like comedy, it should never be like mean. Nothing I'm doing is meant to be like mean spirited, because that's not fun or funny, and like anybody can be mean. It's more about just being absurd and just like wildly inappropriate for the sake of comedy. So I don't know.
You got renewed for a third season just now. This is connecting with people.
That's crazy.
Insane thing that you're doing.
Oh, yeah, it's awesome, man. I'm so happy and That's all working out because I was so broke for like 10 years trying to make a living doing comedy. I was eating beans by candlelight for a decade. It's nuts that the people are listening to the demons in my brain. But I'm happy. It's awesome. I can't believe it.
That's Eric Andre. He's the host of The Eric Andre Show on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. The finale of Season 2 will air this Thursday night. Eric Andre, thank you.
Thank you.
Real fun talking with you.
That was fun. Ring bells, sleigh bells. Ring bells,
sleigh bells. Sleigh bells jingling, ring ting jingling too. Again, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Christmas can be a difficult season if you can't stand the music. You don't want to be a jerk, uncharitable and humorless, but man, all that sentimentality and sweetness can be hard to stomach. If I'm describing you, don't despair. This might just be the Christmas album for you. I'll take a lump of black coal in my stocking this year. Thanks, Santa Claus, for having you here. That's Nick Lowe, the man who gave us What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, and Cruel to Be Kind, among many others. His latest album is called Quality Street, a seasonal selection for all the family, and he joins me now in the studio at NPR West. Welcome.
Thanks. Nice. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you. So, a Nick Lowe Christmas album. How on earth did that happen?
Well, it wasn't my idea to do it. I was approached by Yep Rock, which is my American label, and I couldn't think of anything I wanted to do less, in fact. But I was confused by how... Well, how sort of snooty I felt when they asked me about doing it. It was, I think it's a sort of Brit thing, really.
How so?
Making Christmas records is seen as being a bit, well, not really very cool thing to do. You
right.
know? I mean, even my sort of management, when I finished the record and I was talking about it a lot, you know, they had this sort of look of pity on their face, you know, like you, like you have, you're talking to a bit of a sort of confused neighbor, you know, elderly neighbor. And I can understand why, because that was exactly my reaction when they asked me to do it. And when I started thinking about it and wondering why I felt so sort of hoity-toity about the whole thing, I immediately, of course, realized that it was ridiculous and it could be pretty good. I thought, well, with a little bit of work, we can make it a little bit different, and I thought we could have a lot of fun with it along the way. Silent night. Holy night,
all is calm, all is bright. That Silent Night, that's a very interesting arrangement. Can you talk about how you came up with that?
There's a reason why it's been covered. I think the last time I looked at it, it's had 3,200 covers.
Wow.
There have been of that song. And there's a reason, you know, for it. I mean, it is a great tune. It owes something to a record which I like, a version of that song by Huey Piano Smith and the Clowns from the 1950s. He did that sort of treatment, but I suppose our thing has got a little more of a sort of London style. You know, there's a little ska influence in there, and I don't know what kind of music it is, really, but it's cheerful. In that stable there, kings from afar, wise men singing hallelujah, Christ the Savior is born, Christ the Savior is born.
So you were recording this sort of last spring, so this is probably the first time you've actually played these songs during the Christmas season.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, why don't we hear one then?
That's right. Okay.
How about... Christmas at the Airport?
Yeah, I'll do that one for you. I always think that nothing says it's not Christmas more than a man with an acoustic guitar, but I'll do my best. Here we go, Christmas at the Airport.
Outside the taxi window, on the way to catch my flight, I notice snowflakes playing in the ever-failing light. When he dropped me at departures, It was really coming down. Deep and crisp and even, it settled on the ground. It looks like Christmas, Christmas at the airport. All the planes are grounded and the fog is rolling in. It looks like Christmas, Christmas at the airport this year. Now the doors are locked and bolted. Let the festivities begin. The terminal was seething without much Christmas cheer. So I found an empty closet and I settled down in there. When I awoke much later, I was quite alone. Check-in was deserted, everyone had gone. It looks like Christmas, Christmas at the airport. I took a set of x-rays and they came out pretty well. It looks like Christmas, Christmas at the airport this year. Now I'm doing Santa's sleigh ride on the baggage carousel. Doo-doo. I should be at the table with all my kith and kin. It looks like Christmas, Christmas at the airport this year. Don't save me any turkey, I found a burger in a bin.
That's Nick Lowe in the studio with us. That song is called Christmas at the Airport. It's from his new album, Quality Street, a seasonal selection for all the family. Nick, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
But before you go, we have to hear at least one more tune. Can you play one more tune and tell us a bit about it for us first?
Yes. I think I'm going to do this one, which is, this is another one of my own songs. It's called I Was Born in Bethlehem. I kind of dreamt the title in the first verse when I was sort of waking up one morning in that strange sort of half awake, half asleep. The idea was to imagine if you were sitting next to Jesus on a plane or something and had a couple of cocktails, you know, and he started telling you this story, you know, this Christmas story. So I tried to make it as conversational as I could. So that's the idea behind it.
I was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years of being since then, and I've done what I can to be there when a man can't find a friend on the streets of Bethlehem. As the story always said, we were trying to find a bed. It was cold, I was late, and we stood outside the locked gate of the inn until the kindness of strangers let us in to a stable round the back. Little more than a shack, where my sweet mother, meek and mild, and herself only a child,
gave her best, then took her rest. Do 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 do. At the door then came a knock. Shepherds who had quit their flock, with their eyes round with fear, Daddy jumped up and cried, "Get out of here." But Mother stilled him and bid them draw near. I was there but could not see the unfolding mystery. Kings with their presents of gold, myrrh and frankincense, who set them before the Lamb on the streets of Bethlehem. I was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years have been since then, and I've done what I can to be there when a man can't find a friend. I was born in Bethlehem.
For the week ending December 8th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leah Dell'Aguila. Say it for me, Leah. I don't want to... Dell'Aguila. Dell'Aguila. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leah Dell'Aguila and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.